Success number 27748, Reel 1.
No, I was only a lieutenant in the Navy.
We're going now. Okay, so this is Reel 1, and this is Richard Songer. What year and where were you born?
I was born in 1933 in Red Hill Hospital in Middlesex. But my parents then lived at Kenton in Middlesex, which is a suburb of Harrow.
And what kind of family background were you?
Well, then, when I was born, my father was working in the Gulf trade. He was a travelling salesman. He had a Ford 8 with a box on the back, plywood box, in which, you know, the golf clubs and the umbrellas and all those things. And it was solely on commission. So the poor chap had to go around all these golf clubs selling to the professional shop, you know, which then sold them to the people who were members of the club. So it was must have been very nerve-wracking for him, without a salary. You know, I can understand the stresses of his life now.
And how many were you in the family?
Just myself and my sister. She was 3 years younger.
And, I mean, it was middle class?
Lower middle class, I would say, yes. My mother had a very upright bicycle, and she had an insurance book. And she used to go around, I suppose, getting weekly money from people to pay for their life insurance. So it was pretty hard going, I imagine, for them. But you only realise this much later.
And what about education? What did you...
Everybody around this part of Kenton went to Priestmead Primary School, which was... it was absolutely brand new. Kenton was a new suburb on the Northwick line, and so it was metroland, you know, brand new houses, brand new schools. Everything was, you know, wonderful as far as I'm concerned as a child. You know, I thought school was wonderful, and it had a big hall, and I can still remember singing All Things Bright and Beautiful, the sun streaming in the windows and those motes of dust in there. You know, it was a good life.
And this was during... At the beginning of the war?
I was five in 1938, so I would have gone to school then, and that was when I was obviously singing All Things Bright and Beautiful. Didn't get so beautiful later on.
And were you conscious of the war? Did it impinge upon your day-to-day life?
It did. It sort of... Yes, one minute there was no war, and the next minute there was, because my father gave up... Well, he joined the... what was called the Auxiliary Fire Service in 1939, because, you know, everybody had to do something and people wouldn't be buying golf clubs, I suppose. But, I mean, this wasn't explained to us. And I remember we had to go and wear gas masks at school. And the other interesting thing was that the school was right next to a park. And this was obviously a couple of years into the war, but they dragged a fairy firefly on a Queen Mary, which is an articulated truck, and stuck it in the entrance of the park. There was this complete aeroplane. It had force-landed somewhere, and was it the Air Ministry's way of getting children interested in flight? I don't know, but there it was. And you could climb all over it, jump on the wings, take bits off it. It was our aeroplane. You know, so that gave me an interest in aeroplanes.
What year was that?
Well, that would have probably been about 1942, I imagine, when there had been a few crashes, so they were dragging old aeroplanes around. And whether they did that to other playgrounds or schools, I don't know. But it seems extraordinary to me now. And, of course, going to school in the morning, you go early, and if you had a paper round, you out early, because you wanted to collect shrapnel, because... You know, if you were really lucky, you'd get a nose cap of a shell with markings on it, you know, from where they set where it should explode. So that was all very exciting, from the anti-aircraft shells. We didn't... the nearest bomb we got was in the next street, and that was just a stray one. I mean, the real concentration was not in the suburbs, it was in the East End of London. So my dad, every night, all the fire services around London were on alert, and then they drove in to London, to the Blitz, you know, because that's where the fires were. So all these men went in, and then about 8 o'clock in the morning, they come back absolutely, you know, covered in ash, and their uniforms all singed and faces filthy, you know. Out of the night.
And in quite a state of shock too, I imagine.
Well, yes, I mean, they were, and they, you know, they saw horrible things. And, you know, then I suppose their wives and things, you know, looked after them and bathed them, all the rest of it, and got ready for the next night. So it was a pretty hard time for my parents, I think.
Do you think any of that stress came into the family life? I mean, are you conscious of your father becoming a changed person during that period?
No, because he was hardly ever there. You know, he was always at the station. I don't think he lived at home. I think you lived on the station. I remember he was very keen on shelters and things. So we had an Endon shelter that he put in the garden. But we never went into it because it filled up with water. Yeah, so we didn't actually go into the shelter. So then the government, I think you had to pay, but they provided it was a table shelter. So it was like a steel cage about 3 feet high, about the size of the dining table. And the dining table was moved out of the dining room. And then you got in under it, and you could have a bed in there. So we used to go to bed in there, so to say, being woken up and dragged down. And I suppose our mum would have come down if it sounded like the raid was getting close.
What about games, Dick? I mean, the games that children played.
Oh, yes. Yes, I see what you mean. Yeah, there was lots of games, you know, sort of, I suppose they, yes, you know, we had dog fights and things like that, where you'd make that sort of noise, which is the machine guns going off, and you would see them too, it always seemed to be summer in childhood, and there'd be the vapor trails up there as the, as the Battle of Britain was fought, and then later on other air raids. And then the doodle bugs came. That was the next weapon. That was the ramjet, which it had a noise like a lorry, and then of quite a loud noise, and then it would stop. And that meant that it was then falling. And so if you could hear the noise come over, well, it wasn't going to hit you. And if the noise stopped somewhere away, it might do. So, you know, was that apprehension. But we were out in the park once, and the park keeper was shouting at us to lie down because there was one of these doodle bugs coming. But, of course, we wanted to see where it came down, to see who the hit was. So we didn't lie down. We ran towards it when it came down. It made a blinking great hole in the park. And, looking for bits. Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah.
So as the war went on then, and you were at school, I mean, when you went from primary to secondary education, you'd have been, that was about 41, 42, wasn't it, or 43?
No, 11, yes, that would have been, yes, 44, I think, yeah.
Did you have any inkling then that you wanted really to become a pilot, that first encounter with the plane in the park? And
no, I think that had then faded into background because I failed my 11 plus. I don't know how I managed to do that because I was the head boy of the school, but I failed. I think it was because of the exam system that I wrote a whole... My essay was on what was basically a communist idea of the future, and I think then we'd fallen out of love with the Soviets, and I think that's my opinion why I failed anyway. So I went to a secondary modern school where I did nothing for 2 years because the others still couldn't read and write, and of course I was quite advance in that way. So I spent.
Why were you a communist at 11?
I didn't think of myself as a communist. You know, I didn't know anything about politics. But Miss Driver, the head of the primary school, was very keen. She was, and the school had loads of posters of heroic tractor drivers and these wonderful women reaping corn, and we used to sing sort of those sort of, well, they were Russian songs, I suppose. And she was just a bit out of, but I thought it was reasonable that everybody, when they got, what my essay was about was getting to 18, and everybody was given like a little apartment and basic furniture and all these things. And then from then on, that started them off in life, and then they went on. Well, whoever examined my essay didn't think much of this. Well, I think that's why I failed. Yeah.
So then you went into secondary model and you
did nothing, made models. I was given a special room and I made the teacher's project models. And I did that until I could go to Wilton Technical College, because that was the only other way out to a higher education. You know, it was to go to the technical college. So I went to the technical college and took engineering there. That was Wilton Technical College.
And what did you do? You say you took engineering. What, this would have been an apprenticeship or a?
No, it was a course. I can't remember what it was. I suppose you left with an HND or something. But you know, you did drawing office stuff. You did pattern making. You did welding. You did those sort of things. But it was largely office things. It was largely draftsmanship. You know, a big emphasis on. I suppose because in those days engineering works needed heaps of draftsmen. Before computers and CAD/CAM and all the rest of it, you know, everything was done by pencil and paper.
And this was now in the period, what, in the late 40s?
Yes, yes, it would have been, yeah.
And I suppose there was a lot of rebuilding going on, so there was a big demand for that kind of...
There was a building section to the... the engineers used to throw stones at the builders and vice versa. You know, there was a lot of competition. Yeah, there was big, rebuilding of everything, really.
And what about your interest in flying? Did that keep going?
Yes, I used to. I had a friend who lived up the road who was also. Well, all boys seemed to be keen on model aeroplanes then. We spent all our pocket money on balsa wood dope engines. Little diesel engines had come in then. And we'd go to Northwick Park, which was a big, huge open space of many fields. And fly our planes and hopefully get them back again, because sometimes, you know, they'd just fly off. It was wonderful. It was right behind Northwick Park railway station. It's probably covered in houses now, but it was then a huge open space and ideal for flying gliders.
And so you designed your own planes, or you built ones according to?
We did design our own, but they were never very successful, and it was best to buy a kit. Or a plan, and then build from the plan. That's what we did. But we spent too much time on the finish of them. So they ended up beautifully painted and all the rest of it, but far too heavy, and that's why they weren't very good at flying. You know, we had awful crashes. You'd spend months building a plane, and you didn't balance it right on the first flight. Smash. You know.
And what about the competitions that were going on, the endurance flights? I mean, were you very following that? Were you buying magazines with your friends? And
no, I think we were too young for that. But we knew, I mean, we'd seen the pre-war Schneider Trophy races and that sort of thing. And
when you were 8 or 9, you can remember those.
Yes, because, you know, they'd be on the newsreels. And my father used to take us to the cinema. You know, that was our sort of... probably a weekly treat. There was a brand new Odeon. Everything was sort of new around there, and this Odeon was fantastic, sort of pseudo-Egyptian, wonderful place. A bit like, you know, the multiplexes of now. When you go inside, they just beautifully designed, and this Odeon had this swirly carpet and Egyptian lamps, and yes. And we used to go also Saturday morning cinema. There was it was very cheap, and there were lots of cowboy films. We used to go to that. And also there was newsreels as well, so you saw what was happening in the world. And most of there was a lot of, you know, wartime aviation stuff in those films.
Are we before or after the war now?
No, we're sort of during.
Right, okay. Mm. And so still, you're still not thinking you're going to become a pilot?
No, no, I'm saying...
Why not?
No, I don't know why. I just that at that stage, I think you were in the sort of class, the school as I'd been to most of it, university was something quite out of our ken. You know, nobody went to university. Our parents hadn't been. You didn't meet anybody from that class. We were very much a sort of lower middle class area. So our ambitions were to, you know, get a job in a factory, really. And my friend, who was keen on aeroplanes, for instance, he went to de Havilland at Stag Lane and helped build the Comet and that sort of thing. I, about the same period, he took up his apprenticeship. I joined the Navy as an artificer apprentice because you didn't require any money to do that. You know, you just signed on the line, and then the Navy paid for everything.
So you got your qualification at the technical college?
No, I was only half. I joined the Navy when I was 15, so I'd only done about a year, I suppose, or two.
So you left school at 14 then?
No, I went from the secondary mum to the technical, which was still school, really. The technical college was sort of school. Probably did 1 or 2 years there and then joined the Navy as an artificer apprentice.
And why did you do that? Why the Navy? Why not the Army?
Oh, well, the Army, they lived in holes in the ground. And, you know, no. And I'd read all those. I'd read a lot. And, you know, there were books. You know, there was always McTavish who was keeping the engines going in some old tramp steamer, and I just loved that idea, you know, these huge pistons going up and down. And I'd been on, on a trip on a ship, something, I don't know, but that smell of hot oil, probably traction engines, because in those days there were still steam lorries. The Gaslight and Coke Company used to deliver our coal and coke with this beautiful gleaming machine, which was driven from the front. You know, it was a front-driven thing, and the stoker sat behind the driver stoking up the thing, and it used to drop ash on the streets, you know, below it. Yeah, it was a wonderful thing, a steam lorry, absolutely silent. Yeah. Yeah, so that was the love of steam. I had this love of steam. So joining the Navy, I was going to be looking after these wonderful engines. In actual fact, of course, the Navy at that stage was practically all turbines.
Do you remember anything of the process of joining? You know, what was the moment you thought, oh, I'm going to go into the Navy? Did you talk? Were you recruited? Did you go to a recruiting office? How did that whole process of your induction into the Navy take place?
Yes, I think I must. No, I think it was a sort of newspaper advertisement, you know, saying, you know, apprenticeships, all this sort of thing, and after the. Was it after the war then? How old would I have been? 15? Yes, it was after the war. Life at home deteriorated rapidly. My mother and father, they fell out a lot. And it was very unpleasant at home. My father had periods when he wouldn't speak, like for 3 or 4 months. He would speak to us, but only to say, sort of, pass the pepper, and then we'd have to ask my mum if she'd pass the pepper, you know, that sort of thing. And would he speak by Christmas, you know, because all this sort of thing, it was really awful. And so I really ran away from home, that's what it boiled down to. So we filled in this form, and then you went to a sort of induction place where they tested you on sort of little problems. You know, there were a whole group of boys and you were in a big gymnasium and you sort of had to get planks across notional rivers and all this sort of nonsense. I suppose they were looking for leadership qualities or something, but that's how, you know, some people were obviously not chosen. There was a lot of people there. And then you were summoned to Fisgard, which was near Tor Point. You came down there in your civilian clothes, and then you were, you know, given uniforms and a hut to live in. And so it started.
Was that seen as the? Were you doing the right thing? Did people say, "Oh, why are you going into starting as a lowly artificer?" When you
Oh, within my in our class of people, I think that was considered a step up. You know, to join the Navy was, you know, that was a good thing to do. Because the Cold War was on, all the rest of it, and I suppose the population felt, you know, they wanted young men to do that sort of thing. And being an artificer was a trade as well. It wasn't, you weren't just being a sailor, you were going to be somebody who spent at least 4 years training, you know, as your you were an artificer apprentice, so that's what you were actually gaining. You were gaining a trade.
Was there any patriotic feeling as well? You were doing your bit for the country, you'd gone through the war, you'd seen...
I suppose so, but you know, you yourself didn't think that, but probably your parents thought it. I mean, nobody thought it was a silly thing to do.
This idea of defending.
Yes, it was still that business of defending, yes. You were actually... England needed to keep all this going after the end of the Second World War.
And so you arrive in Fiskard.
Yes, very frightened,
like?
15 years old, because I was very small then. I didn't grow until I was about 18, so I was only about 5 foot, and there was a lot of bullying. And a lot of the other boys were, you know, fully mature and big and knew about girls and things like that, and I certainly didn't know anything about that. Yes, and so you were given your clothes, and then you were given a hut, and each... all the same term were in the hut, so you were all the same intake. But at the end of the hut was a little sort of separate room in which a petty officer, artificer, apprentice, who was probably 3 terms ahead of you, and he was in charge of that hut and had quite considerable authority. And so that's how the hut was run. And it had a stove in the middle of it, a coke stove, and, you know, duties were you had to go and get the coke and you had to keep the stove going. Why we didn't all suffer from monoxide poisoning, I can't think, because the windows were always shut and they were freezing cold. Concrete huts, one block thick, you know.
And the training, was it good?
Yes, I think it was. Yes, it was good as far as learning your trade. I mean, the workshops were huge. There was a huge parade ground, and right behind that parade ground was what was virtually... It was called the factory. It was a factory. You know, it was multi-laned, one of those sawtooth roofs, and full of rows and rows of lathes, rows and rows of milling machines. And so, you know, if you were doing milling or turning, there's great rows of you at your lathe, and they were all belt driven, you know, so they had these huge belts thrashing around, and the machines were very old. The lathes were probably pre-war, probably out of the dockyard, and so they all, you couldn't just rely on them to be accurate. You had to sort of nudge them and adjust them all the time. It was, and the test jobs that you had to do required considerable accuracy, you know, within a thou. That's what they were measured to, and you were having to put bits of paper and stuff to get the damn thing to turn straight. So you did learn a lot, and you learned a lot about being sort of reliant, you know, making do. Yeah, making do. The machinery was rubbish, and it required a fair amount of skill to get a decent performance out of it.
And what about the other side, the discipline, the social life? I mean, you were close to Plymouth. You were there for how long at Fiskard?
I was there for 2 years, I think. But don't forget, we were young, and the pay was... And you weren't allowed... You were allowed out from Saturday about 12 o'clock until... I think you had to be back by 11. Well, the bus trip to the Torpoint Ferry, then you were over the Torpoint Ferry. It was a steam-driven ferry in those days, which is another... excitement or a laugh, you know, you could see down below and you could see the piston going backwards and forwards and all that. And then you had to wear a uniform, so you were a 16-year-old boy wearing a uniform in Plymouth, which was actually a naval town with great lusty sailors in it and all the rest of it. I mean, you were at a huge disadvantage as far as social life in Plymouth concerned. So you had to scuttle back by, no, It was a waste of time, really. You'd go to the cinema, that's about what you did. Yeah.
And what about the discipline side of it?
That was that didn't seem to be a problem. You had these dreadful parades and things once a week and all that. Yeah, I suppose it was a sort of self-discipline as well. It was pretty strict. I mean, there were all sorts of punishments if you fell out of line. You know, it still beat people. You know, there was a special cane, and the Master of Arms administered this.
You're kidding, really?
Yes. I remember I got kicked in the groin by somebody, and I had to go to hospital. And then the chap who kicked me was beaten, and it was one of these sort of playground things, you know. He had to wear duck trousers, which was sort of canvas trousers, and given six strokes of this cane. You know, it was very.
It's almost like going back 100 years before.
Well, no, they didn't. You didn't have to go back. The Navy'd been doing this all the time.
But at the same moment, technologically, it was a very exciting time because, especially in aerial terms, there was a huge,
coming
in. And was your interest in?
Oh, yes.
Flying, growing and growing and growing.
Well, there was a model airplane club run by, what was his name? Eric Jones, who eventually ran an art gallery in Southeast Cornwall. But Eric was his job to run this model airplane club to attract artists apprentices to the aeronautical side of it. And, you know, I was an easy convert, and so I used to go to all this model airplane club. And so after your 2 years at Fisgard, you then had to choose to either be a gunnery engineer, electrical engineer, shipwright, or an aeronautical apprentice. And so I chose aeronautical, and then we went to Arbroath in Scotland, at the airfield there, where you were trained then on aeroplanes. And so, you know, it was a completely different world to the engine room. You know, we thought we were getting into much more exciting things, clean work on aeroplanes, not filthy overalls in the bottoms of a ship. Because we did have practical. You went to the fleet and did practical work in boiler rooms and engine rooms, so you knew what you were getting into.
And how did that, I mean, when you first did that, where did you go?
Well, to Devonport and then out to sea in minesweepers and things like that.
For how long?
Oh, not for long. You know, probably a couple of days, something like that. I'm not so sure did we stay on the ships overnight? Maybe we did. Can't remember.
But this gave you pretty much an aversion for
going. Yes, that's right, because it was, you know, boiler rooms and engine rooms are very hot, dirty places. And, you know, fuel oil swilling about and if you're a junior person, you know, you're in the dirtiest part of it as well. And also you're down below, you know, you're shut away from the action. I mean, I wanted to be where you could see what was going on. And anyway, aeroplanes were, you know, exciting things. So I grew out of steam.
Did you ever go on board a carrier before you, I mean?
No, I don't think we went on a carrier. I remember we all put on a fleet tender to go out to see what was that ship that got shot at by the communists up the Yangtze? The Amethyst. And when she came back, still with the big holes in her side, you know, all the Navy went out to meet her in the Sound and cheered her in and all that stuff. I remember doing that.
Who was that? That was in the...
Well, that was being in the 50s. But I don't know exactly the date of it.
Where are we now? So, was it difficult to become an aeronautical officer?
No, you were selected. You know, I think it was done on the results of your test jobs and things, because all the way through this training, you were making things which were marked. And you were also writing, you know, you had to do maths and physics and all this sort of stuff, schoolwork. So you were, you I think the highest things were were the aircraft side. If you got good marks, then you could go and be an aircraft artist's apprentice. So that's how we ended up there. So we were quite bright lads up there, or we had thought we were bright lads.
So you're up in now in Arbroath. Now you're working with the machines that you've been playing with as a child. It really must have been.
Yes, it was
very.
Yes, it was very exciting, and you were doing. You were learning all the parts of, you know, how to make airplanes out of aluminium. In those days, some flying control surfaces were still covered in doped canvas to make them lighter. And so we used to sew linen onto tailplanes.
Richard Songer, Reel 2.
When we finished sewing them on, you had to tauten it with dope and then paint it with a camouflage canvas and all that. So you covered every field of aeronautical engineering. Then you worked on engines, took them apart, put them back together again, all that sort of thing. And then one day...
What kind of planes were you working on there?
Oh, really old, beaten up things like Fireflies and Dominies. You know, Dominies were de Havilland biplane, you know, hence a lot of canvas work. We were working on worn out aeroplanes from the fleet, that's what it boiled down to, so that, you know, we could take them apart and put them together again. And while I was up there, you can tell we were running the fleet air on down, because we had a huge scrap pile, and I got a brand new Merlin piston out of the scrap pile, and I've still got it, use it as an ashtray. Brand new, it seems such a terrible waste, straight out of a Spitfire engine out of a Merlin.
And when was the first time that you went up?
Ah, when we